Some of you might have heard about the Gamelan Project, which explores the possibility of using music training to improve attention. So what I'm going to tell you about the electrophysiological side of the Gamelan Project, which we have been developing. So isochronous means equally spacing time, like beep, 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 beep. And we think that this is a great window. Rhythm is a great window to see how time is processed in the brain, especially because when you're doing EEG, it doesn't make much sense to ask someone to wait for 20 seconds or estimate time in a different form before having a response, because it's too long, there's not enough trials. And rhythm is a very automatic thing. You perceive it even when you're asleep. So we're looking for brain signatures of time processing and how they correlate with the cognitive characteristics of the individuals. Okay? In a graphical sense, we're looking for a measure of how you process time as an individual, how good you process time. And then we can correlate that with other things that you can do. For example, focus your attention. So if we see that there is a correlation that individuals that are more sensitive to time are also better attenders, we can think that really improving your sensitivity to time might improve your ability to pay attention. And because we were interested in things like attention, we want to develop a task that doesn't require attention. So we want to correlate something with attention. We want to make sure that that something, it doesn't involve attention. Many of the tasks, just because they are tasks, many of the EEG tasks involve attention. The subject has to do something. So if you see that kids that have problems with attention don't do it as well, it's not surprising. It's not surprising that the brain signals are different either. So we wanted to develop a task that is not a task, so that it doesn't require attention. Sorry. This is a passive listening paradigm in which we have two conditions, a long condition and a short condition, and it's just playing beeps, and the subject is just sitting there trying not to fall asleep and sometimes actually achieving it. So the long condition goes beep, 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 okay? And then there's another condition that is twice as fast. And the important thing is that there is a time deviant in the long condition. And that time deviant, the interval of that time deviant matches the interval of a standard pause in the short condition. So we can compare two stimuli that are exactly the same. The only difference is that deviant doesn't come at the expected time of the beat. Comes in the offbeat, actually. So what we find, and this is, we did it for a few subjects, the results are consistent, is that the response to the time deviant is much bigger than the response to a similar stimulus that comes at the expected time. So we probably have a measure of the sensitivity to time that can be applied to an individual. And we use a very sophisticated computational technique here that's called error bars that we recommend the EEG community to use. So we correlate this with a, actually I'll go ahead and skip this. We correlate this with the ability to synchronize while tapping, and we have some results for that too. But I want to tell you, so what we need right now is more subjects, and we're developing a partnership with High Tech High School in San Marcos, in which we're going to go to the school, take the equipment, and use the keys as subjects, but at the same time we'll be teaching them about our project. We're going to have the kids helping us do the experiment, and by being subjects, they're going to be understanding the scientific process and the fact that the questions are not answered yet. So this is it's very useful for us to get a lot of subjects, and we and the kids and the teachers are very excited about this. Thank you.
I have a question.
Yes.
So I guess I want to challenge you on this task does not require attention. I mean, I think there's a difference between not measuring attention because you're not asking, you know, for responses.
I agree.
Right.
I cannot really...
Which makes a difference for how you're... I mean, it sounded like you really want to make an inference from a task that does not require attention, but if you measured, you know, performance on detecting the deviance and manipulations of attention influenced it, then the whole claim wouldn't work.
No.
Because you would have a task sensitive to attention.
We are not asking them to detect...
But you're not. But because you're not measuring that doesn't mean that how much attention they're paying.
Yeah, we cannot control how much they attend. We cannot control what they think of. At least... We know that in the other experiments, attention is specifically involved. At least in this case, they don't need to do it. But you're right. There is a chance that we might ask them to do something else that's very simple, which other people has done. But we're not sure yet. But we eliminate attention as good as we can. It's not the same.
We should talk, but I disagree.
What?
I don't agree. I think you're not measuring it, and so you're eliminated it from your as a variable.
So
that you're using.
What do you mean?
Well, like, you know, when I listened to you while you talked, I was doing passive listening, but of course I wasn't. I have internal goals,
passive.
And well, you're not measuring my listening in that context.
Yeah, sorry.
All right, how's that? Okay, excellent. So, my name is Brian, and I am the spotlight speaker that Dan alluded to earlier. So I'm a second year graduate student in his lab, and I think I got just about the best introduction a spotlight could possibly have. So I guess I'll be talking about some of the implications that Dan alluded to, and we were just gonna ask, is there any immediate obvious change after sensory deprivation in gamma modulations? To put this in context, Dan, I think, did a good job of this already. So a lot of modeling work in the last 15 years has shown that fast spiking cells are very well equipped to play a significant role in producing gamma oscillations. And so these have also been related by the Benesich lab and others to predicting ability to learn and cognitive abilities in general. So it seems like a nice way to integrate what we study into the learning framework. So the results Dan was describing suggest that there are several different processes that are affecting fast spiking, specifically the plasticity in fast spiking cells. So then we were interested in asking, okay, so what are the effects on gamma? Ultimately, can this be related to an effect on learning? So real quickly, Dan already kind of summarized this. We study this system because there's a great somatotopic map of whisker input into primary somatosensory cortex. So it's pretty easy to do recordings. The paradigm that I was following, Dan described already, it's identical to that previous research. So I, starting at 12 days after birth, I pluck the D row whiskers. And so then after that, we let them regrow. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to wiggle them and see how the brain's responding. So I let the whiskers regrow for about 3 days. So here is a very simplified view of the data that I'm collecting. So the rats are under anesthesia. So these are anesthetized animals. And I'm just doing a very basic task. I'm just wiggling their whiskers with a piezo bimorph. And I'm recording single channel recordings. And where I'm recording from are two different layers. So I'm recording in the barrel column that is encoding information from that specific whisker. And I'm recording from spared and deprived columns. And so I'm recording from layer 2, 3, and layer 4, and just single channel, just kind of getting an idea of what's going on. Six animals, I got paired recordings, both layers. So here's a raw LFP trace. So this hasn't been filtered, but when I analyze this, so there's the whisker stimulus onset. I played all different stimuli, but that's kind of a different question here. So what I'm going to talk about is specifically this rest period. So I take spectrograms of many different single recordings during this rest period and took average spectra, and I just took a general look at that. And so when I'm looking at layer 4, I have a general, so here's an average spectra from layer 4 looking at normalized power, so normalized by animal, and to the peak power in spared columns, and you see no real difference. And I mean, that kind of fits. Typically in plasticity, you don't see any change in layer 4 spiking activity. Also, it's an anesthetized animal, there's no stimulus. Like, it'd be very surprising, perhaps. But when I do look at layer 2, 3, I see a significant change across frequencies. So every frequency from 20 to 90 that we're looking at, there's a significant drop in the power of LFP during these resting periods. But if you kind of squint at this for a while, you realize you kind of see that there might be a bigger difference specifically right around here. So if you can bin these up into 10 hertz bins, do some multiple comparisons, there is actually a greater difference between 40 and 50 hertz than any other bin. And that's a relevant frequency because people who have been able to do optogenetic studies where they just stimulate fast spiking cells see sort of a circuit resonance between 40 and 50 hertz. So that could be interesting. Again, these are just is it the instantaneous firing? Doesn't look like it. So it's not just spiking activity. This seems to be something to do with local field potentials. And to put this back in context, this is just sort of a very preliminary look at seeing is there anything that we could pick out about gamma changing. And it seems like there is. So future directions would be to look at awake animals, hopefully integrate some sort of learning paradigm so that you can track this change from what we know at the cellular level. So. Thank you for your time. And
can everybody hear me? I'll give a brief overview of our research on single trial analysis for predicting memory of visual stimuli from pre-stimulus EEG. And this is a joint project between the DeSalle lab at UCSD and Tim Curran's lab at University of Colorado. And previous research on pre-stimulus brain activities for successful memory encoding showed that there is significant enhancement in the brain activity starting from the theta band all the way up to the alpha and beta band for the remembered items compared to the forgotten items using MEG and intracranial EEG. And we want to find these differences from single trial EEG data. So our goal is to predict whether the subject remembers a given stimulus or not, using the pre-epic of each presentation in the study phase, which is the portion highlighted in yellow here. So the experiment has two phases, the study phase and the recognition phase. And in the study phase, subjects are given study items on the computer screen. And in this experiment, they were pictures of cars or birds. And in the recognition phase, they have to distinguish these target items from distractors using a rating scale with 5 options. And for this class, for classification, we divided these options into 3 groups: recollect, familiar, and unfamiliar. And we only consider recollect versus unfamiliar classification here. So this table gives the classification results for all 18 subjects. And 11 out of the 18 subjects perform significantly over chance with respect to the number of trials per class. And none of the results go significantly below 50%. And the combined classification accuracy for all 18 subjects is 57%, which is also significantly over chance. We also conducted further analysis to see whether the classifier would work on an online experiment. So in the current study, subjects are given study items at predetermined time points. And this forces the classifier to give a decision even when the subjects are not particularly in a good or bad brain state. But in the online study, we would only present study items when the classifier is highly confident that the brain is in a good or bad state. And we would compare the subject's behavioral performance between those two states. So we perform classification again on the trials that have high classification confidence for either class. And we want to note that classification accuracy is not guaranteed to improve by discarding the low confidence trials. So this graph shows how the classification accuracy varies as we vary the proportion of trials with high confidence. And the average accuracy for the 18 subjects is increased from 57% to 61% when only the 10% of the most high confidence trials are considered. And for the 11 classifiable subjects, this is increased from 60% to 66%. And the average of the 11 classifiable subjects shows a monotonic increase as the confidence of the classifier increases, as shown in this figure here, which indicates that the classifier is detecting a biologically relevant signal. So in conclusion, we're able to classify whether the subject remembers a given visual stimulus or not from the pre-stimulus EEG data for 11 out of the 18 subjects. And from the high confidence analysis, we found that the classification problem is well formed. And there is strong evidence that an online classifier based on the offline analysis could be utilized to successfully find good or bad brain states in the online experiment. Thank you.
How did you quantify the offline
study?
Did you characterize what the brain state actually was?
No, we haven't gone into the online experiment yet. So the good brain state would just be the trials where they remembered the study items, and the bad would be the ones where they didn't.
All right, you might have noticed the change of the title of this talk, but I think I was able to streamline it and cut it down to the most relevant core findings. So before I begin this talk, I'd like to emphasize that there is a tremendous ERP literature on spatially relevant stimulus, perceiving stimuli in space. And all of these studies have consistently shown that spatially non-attended stimuli elicit a negative going wave between 140 and 200 milliseconds following the stimulus presentation. So I will present results from a collaborative study with Stephen Hilliard and Steve Gefstein, Steve Hilliard and Sergey Gefstein, where we see consistent results during the preparation of spatially directed movements. To our surprise, we do not see these ERP components during the preparation of non-spatially directed limb movements. That is, when movements are not directed towards visual stimuli presented on the screen. Our experimental setup is depicted in this slide, and it allows synchronous recordings of EEG, eye, and limb movements. And in this particular task, targets are presented in the periphery of this touchscreen, while subjects have to fixate at and point their finger at the screen center for a randomized time interval. We call it hold interval. It's randomized between 5 and 700 milliseconds. Following this, subjects have to perform either a look and reach, look at or reach movement towards the lateralized target. And so this happens in this stage number 5. But for this talk, I'd like to concentrate on this so-called hold interval. So the target is already visible, but subjects are not allowed to look out there or to reach out there until the center goes off. And so we have a couple of different conditions. So the spatially directed movements include to look out and to reach out to the target, to only look out to the target or to reach out to the target or, and this is the relevant condition for this talk, to just perform a non-spatially directed lift of the hand from the screen center. So this is not directed to the visual stimulus. The central question was, given that we have the same visual stimuli in all these conditions, will there be an ERP response towards the target, although it is not attended? The ERP waves you can see here are channel-wise grand averages during the hold interval, preceding either spatially, non-spatially directed hand lifts, colored in green, or variations or combinations of spatially directed movements. And these are all the other conditions. And you can see that in occipital and parietal areas, there is a striking modulation of negative going components around 200 milliseconds. But this is not the case for the simple hand lifts. Later ERP components, such as the P300 that deal with general aspects of attention, they are modulated across all these conditions. So to conclude, unlike previous studies in visual processing, stimuli preceding non-spatially directed movements fail to elicit spatially sensitive ERP components in that time interval between 140 and 200 milliseconds. These results might indicate that spatial attention is modulated by processes that evaluate how important stimulus is for an upcoming behavioral response. And I'm happy to discuss all these results during the lunch hour and the next hours of this meeting. Thank you for your attention.
All right, so here I'm just going to give you a whirlwind tour of the source information flow toolbox. It's going to be fast-paced, but hopefully informative. All right. So an important goal for many of us in cognitive or computational neuroscience is to measure dynamic changes or temporal changes in neural dynamics and information flow that can index and predict task-relevant changes in cognitive state and behavior. And there's some important factors like accuracy and validity of our models, temporal specificity, and non-invasive measurement measures are preferred for humans. So when we're working with non-invasive techniques like MEG or EEG, we usually assume that we have some coupled sources whose electromagnetic fields propagate instantaneously to electrodes where the current's measured. And a convenient approach for modeling the dynamics of the system is to adopt a discrete state space model. So here we might have some known exogenous inputs like a stimulus, for example. And we have a state transition equation that describes the temporal dynamics of the latent sources and or their coupling parameters. And finally, we might have an observation equation that describes how the latent states are translated into the observed data. And our goal here is to infer the latent source and or coupling dynamics from the sensor observations. So this is a pretty general model. It subsumes a variety of common linear and nonlinear modeling techniques, including VAR methods and DCM. So one possibility is to assume the source dynamics follow a vector autoregressive process. And from this representation, we can get a variety of popular frequency domain dynamical measures describing different aspects of bivariate or multivariate functional and effective connectivity. So for instance, we can get the spectral density matrix, the bivariate coherency, bivariate Granger-Gwecki causality, the partial coherency, the multivariate extensions of Granger causality like the PDC, the partial directed coherence. So SIFT is a MATLAB toolbox for performing this kind of information flow and dynamical systems analysis across time, frequency, and anatomical location. It's GUI-enabled and integrated into the EEG lab software environment and has an emphasis on vector autoregression and time frequency domain representations. It's got a modular architecture that forms a pipeline, and I'll just quickly step through the elements here in the next few slides. So skipping pre-processing for brevity, let's just cut straight to modeling. And here we have several linear and nonlinear VAR and SSM approaches available. There's pros and cons to each of these methods, so you just kind of pick the one that best suits you and your data. So all the modules come with GUIs to facilitate user interaction. There's various visualization-enabled helper routines. So for instance, here we have a helper for assessing the optimal VAR model order. And once you fit a model, you want to assess the quality of the fit. So for this, we have a validation module to provide several statistical tests. And again, we have handy visualizations to help us. And once we have a good model fit, we can proceed to connectivity analysis. And there's over 15 popular functional and effective connectivity methods implemented so far. Here's the GUI. And if you want to determine whether your connectivity estimates are significant, There's various robust non-parametric and parametric approaches available for obtaining p-values, confidence intervals, and the like. Here's a nice little GUI for that again. And finally, there's a number of routines for visualizing your results. So this includes a highly customizable interactive time frequency grid, and that allows you to explore ERSPs or information flow or synchronization between channels or sources across time and or frequency. And interacting with it does useful stuff like calling up more detailed information. If you have source locations, you can visualize the time evolving network dynamics in the anatomical source space with the BrainMovie 3D tool. And some graph theoretic analysis can be performed here as well. Or you can use a custom interface to the MATLAB bioinformatics toolbox that allows you to interact with 2D directed graphs, do additional graph theoretic analysis, et cetera. Finally, the group analysis module, which is in late stage prep, contains methods for multi-subject inference and statistics with support for missing data. For instance, here's an example of time evolving theta band dynamics from 24 subjects following an ICA decomposition. And here's the corresponding network graph. So sometimes it's a real kind of pain in the ass to create detailed, realistic simulations. So SIFT provides a tool for that. So for instance, suppose we wanted to simulate this non-stationary trivariate process. We just write out the system dynamical equations with the assistance of some helper routines. And then with a few more lines of code, we basically get our result. And describing arbitrary time-varying dynamics is really simple as well. You can just plug it in directly there. Great, so if you're thinking any of this might be useful for you, you can grab SIFT from the SCCN website there. There's a 70-page handbook to help you get started also. And there's lots of applications. For instance, you could use it for event-related connectivity analysis, or you could apply it to single trial EEG or ECOG data to study resting state dynamics or to look at pathologies like epilepsy. SIFT can also be applied to ECOG or LFP data as well as EEG. You just have to kind of just put your stuff in EEG lab format. Or you might want to use it for a brain-computer interface. We're working on that interface right now. There's a lot to do ahead. Making it easier for the user community to contribute to SIFT is an important component. And lots of people have contributed via conversations or code. So I'll close by giving them and you all a big thank you. Thanks.
That's supposed to read that. Thanks, Gary. Okay. Hi, I'm Dave DiRiso. I'm part of the Machine Perception Laboratory, and last year the TDLC generously funded my small grant proposal to develop a method for combining MEG and DTI. So the goal is to look at how functional interactions change as a result of learning. Rather than looking at how activity changes in a single ROI, we want to look at how functional connectivity changes between regions. In addition, we want to integrate anatomical information into this measure. So MEG is a nice measure of neural activity because of its high spatial and temporal resolution. Using Vestal sparse source reconstruction technique developed by Dr. Mishuang Hong at UCSD Radiology, MEG data can be shown in atlas space as time-varying cortical and subcortical signals with millisecond resolution. Using a method developed by Hagmen, diffusion anatomical data can be shown as a network map. So the goal is to combine the two. And so starting with the MEG source reconstruction using the Vestal technique, we then compute tractography using FSL's diffusion toolkit. And then right now, the project exists as a visualization technique where you overlay temporal correlations on top of the DTI pathways. So an example task, and we've run several tasks using this technique, is a decision-making task. And the subject is shown a colored shape and then asked if the color and shape combine to represent left or right. And the subject is informed if they're correct or incorrect. And presumably over time, the subject gets better at this. And so as the reaction time and accuracy improve, I wanted to know what the neural correlates for this process was in terms of connectivity. And the study is very much in progress. We've collected the data, 10 subjects, but so far, the pathway is still under development. But this is what the data looks like for an individual subject. And what you see is the magnitude of the correlation between regions, not the magnitude of activity. I'm going to try to play a video. And so on the top, you see these correlations, and they're calculated by taking the time-varying functional connectivity within a 200 millisecond sliding window. We compute the time-delayed cross-correlation between sources across a range of time lags, and then we pick the lag time that maximizes this correlation. At this optimal time lag, we visualize the correlation and the associated lag-lead relationship. In this case, it's delineated as blue is a lag and red is a lead. And so I wrote the visualization software, and it's very much in pre-beta form. So forgive the poor resolution. But you can see that over time, the connectivity does morph. And what we want to do is see that over a range of subjects as they improve the accuracy and reaction time. And we're doing, right now, we're looking at how this sort of learning occurs in the spatial and perceptual domains. And again, we've already collected 10 subjects, and this is with Dr. Martin Bartlett and with Howard Poisner. What we'd like to do now is use causality measures. And Tim talked about his SIFT toolkit. It's a wonderful toolkit we'd like to implement. And I've been talking with Tim about doing this. And also, we want to find interesting ways of combining the DTI with the MEG. And one such way is to use the anatomical data to inform the optimal lag time. But again, that's very much subject to the research, which is ongoing. And hopefully, we'll be able to report progress soon. So thank you for your time. Any questions?